that to follow. And I promise I won't sing, because those of you that know me know that's not a good idea if I were to sing. I'm a little bit confused this morning because I see Emery's here, and I thought, well, I thought he said he didn't have a teacher, you know. But
that's not my time up the bat, Steve.
Yeah, there we go.
You know, Steve, you're a pinch hitter for Zach, and you know, a pinch hitter is the guy the coach thinks will get the hit instead of the regular guy. There you are,
buddy. All right. Well, I appreciate the opportunity, even though this is pretty early for me. I'm usually out mucking horse stalls at this time of day. So this is better than that, I'll say that. The only problem is I don't think Janice is going to be home doing that while I'm here, so I'll have to go back to it after lunch. But I didn't ask Alan this morning or this week after he called me. And by the way, he gave me plenty of notice this time.
How about that?
So normally I get a call, like, you know, the night before. And then I have an excuse, like, I didn't have time to prepare. I didn't have time to prepare, though, because I was camping in the woods. And so we were up in East Texas until yesterday having a good time. But because of that, I didn't talk to him to say, well, hey, have you already talked about this? Hey, I asked him last week when he called. I said, you know, what are you doing in that class? And he said, oh, we're doing, I believe he said, the characters of the Bible. Is that what you're saying? Well, tell me what you told me.
I think I said you were a character, but I can't remember the story at that time. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you a question. You got two choices this morning. I can talk about Esther and Mordecai if you'd like, or we could talk about the rite of the ritual of the red heifer. And so I'm going to talk about Esther and Mordecai, unless you had that last week.
That's good.
Okay. Okay. So okay, we're good then. Well. Not too many people like to talk too much. I guess really Esther is one of those books that's kind of like the Song of Solomon. You know, it's not one that you normally spend a lot of time with in your Bible reading. One thing, it's an unusual book. It, as you know, it's a great short story. It's one of the, and literally speaking, I don't know whether that's a word or not, but it really is a beautiful book. And if you could read Greek, which I can't, I understand that the Greek is very formal and very eloquent, and so this book would knows. Isn't that what he said?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right. Lillian called me yesterday and wondering where I was, and so she told me she had some plastic surgery done, and she what, a little boy, 2 years old or so, saw her with her implant or whatever, and said nose. So I'm sorry about that. Now, where was I? I don't remember.
You could have left that part.
I know I could. But you wouldn't let me off that easy. So anyway, the book is a little unusual in many ways. One is, like I said, it's a very eloquent book, and it is a terrific short story. But we know it's also historical, and it's also obviously biblical, even though it's unusual in the sense that it's the only book in the Bible in the Old Testament that doesn't mention God. Not one time. You don't have one single mention of God here. But God is implicated and woven throughout this book and throughout the things that happen in the book of Esther. Primarily, the book covers a couple of really, really, really important Hebrew characters. Pilat.
It's the only book that mentions India two times.
It only mentions what?
India.
India, that's right. That's a good point. It does. It's true. And we'll talk about some of those boundaries and so forth in a minute. But they did go over there. Lots of people, you know, not only conquerors in this day, but prior to that, you know, everybody seemed to want to have empires from Mesopotamia and Levant all the way back to India. Not too many of them made it as far as China, but they seem like they liked India a great deal, and that's happened throughout history, and even up until the 19th century when the English, the British owned, the British were dominating India. But anyway, this book primarily focuses on a very, very interesting, even if it were not actual fact, a very interesting set of events. And it really, the scene is set at the height of the Persian Empire. Remember, the Persian Empire came along right after the Babylonians. And in fact, if you biblically, the march of empires, if you will, in the Bible, are first, we always think of Assyria first. Remember, the Assyrians were strong throughout the 8th, well, actually probably the 9th, 8th and 7th century B.C., and the Assyrians were probably one of the first in that part of the world that established an empire, and they were some of the most ruthless and cold-hearted and warlike. In fact, the Assyrians, along with the Persians and the Greeks, were some of the first people that developed some really sophisticated military tactics and so forth. And so the Assyrians were particularly cruel and were not as nice people as even the Babylonians or the Persians. But anyway, they were the Assyrians were first, and then of course the Assyrian Empire ended sometime in the early, actually the late 700 period, 709 BC. They were defeated at a very famous battle by the Babylonians, and so they kind of faded away. And the Babylonians actually were part of the Assyrian Empire. They were kind of like cousins. And you know how cousins do. They have family feuds. And so the Babylonians actually rose up and under a couple of really powerful rulers established for a short time the Babylonian Empire. For about 70 years, they were the zenith of the empire builders. And then Persia started flexing its strength. And of course, they came along, and that's really the setting of this story. We're about at the height of the Persian Empire during the time of Esther and Mordecai. Now, let me go back a little bit to the Babylonians. You know what happened with the Babylonians. They and the Assyrians believed in a certain military tactic it was quite effective, actually. Their military tactic was that if you displace people from their homelands, then they're not as likely to rebel. And the Assyrians and the Babylonians practiced this. You know, when the Assyrians defeated the Jews, the northern kingdom of Israel, in 722 B.C., Samaria fell, which was a capital. And what did they do with most of the people that were in that part of the world? What did they do with the Israelites? Did they just leave them alone and say, okay, just keep paying us money and everything's good? No, they scattered them, didn't they? They hauled them away and scattered them all over Mesopotamia, all over modern-day Turkey, and even north around the Black Sea and that area. And in fact, that's where the term, you've heard, of course, Mormons talk about this a lot, but the ten lost tribes of Israel. Well, how did they get lost? Did they not have a compass? That's not exactly what the deal was it? What does that mean, the ten lost tribes of Israel? Anybody want to comment on that? Well, they actually were scattered, and they never came back together as a nation, or never came back and returned to their homeland. Unlike the tribes of Judah, who did come back, and we'll get to that in just a minute, and we're going in a long, long, torturous path to get to this, but I want you to understand some of the background and the march of history. They just never returned because they were scattered, and in their place, what did the Assyrians, who did the Assyrians assimilate in Israel? They didn't just leave it vacant, did they? See, they moved all those people out, and who did they put in their place? Well, a whole bunch of people. people that they had defeated from other places, right? So they just swapped places in some cases. So they moved in a bunch of Mesopotamian people and people who were what we might call Slavs from the Black Sea area. And they all came and were placed in Israel or in those places that they had defeated. Those people intermarried with a few people who were left. The Assyrians didn't catch everybody. They didn't run all the Jews off and haul them away into captivity because they couldn't get all of them. So there was a residual group of people there that were Jewish, and they intermarried over the years with those Assyrian displaced people. And those people were very well known even in Jesus' day. And what were they called? Samaritans, right? And they were a mixed race of people in the eyes of the Jews. And so the Jews didn't like them for a lot of reasons. One is they were mixed race. They were not pure Jewish. But also, remember, they sacrificed in a different place like the nation of Israel did when the kingdom was separated. And where did they offer their sacrifices? Well, one of two places. Dan. They had a temple there at Dan, which was a very northern part of Israel. And then they had another one to the south at Bethel. And in fact, that was done real early in the kingdom. The first ruler, of course, of Israel did that because he didn't want all these 10 tribes of Israel to be going back to Jerusalem all the time. He figured they might make up and be friends again, and he didn't want that. He wanted to rule over Israel, and so he made it convenient, kind of like a convenience store to shop, so they could do sacrifices there rather than going to Jerusalem, which is kind of weird because Bethel was only like 12 miles from Jerusalem, so it wasn't very far, but he didn't want them doing that. And as a result of that, they started out worshiping in an idolatrous way because God had told the Jews where he wanted them to sacrifice and where he wanted them to go when they had holy days, and that was Jerusalem. So they were burning sacrifices and so forth in places that were not authorized. And as a result, Israel didn't last very long because they fell into idolatry very early. And unfortunately, the nation of Israel continued in idolatry their whole history. By the way, I'm throwing out a lot of stuff here, and so probably don't need to, but it kind of helps with the theme, I think, of Esther, and we'll get to that in a minute. How many good kings were there in the nation of Israel?
One.
Okay, there's one vote for one. Anybody else? Now, that doesn't mean that they didn't have some good qualities from time to time, but if you read the book of 1 and 2 Kings or 1 and 2 Chronicles, it has a pattern to it, doesn't it? It says, and in year such and so, so king such and so ruled over Israel, and he lived to the age of such and so, and he was a son of somebody, and then it says something to the effect, and he sinned like his fathers, or had the same sin nature as his fathers, and continued to burn sacrifices to idols. And in fact, every one of the Israelite kings, every one of them, it says that. So there were some really, really, really powerful kings of Israel, and I think, you know, but there were some awful ones, weren't they? But all of them were idolaters, and all of them were condemned by God. So if I were answering that question, then I understand there were some better than others, but I would say zero. There were no good ones in Israel. And in Judah, you'll see a balance. You'll see some good ones, some bad ones. The last real good one was Josiah, you remember? And then about 100 years prior to him was Hezekiah. They were both great kings. But for the most part, toward the end, they were very much like Israel as well. They were bad kings. So, that being the case, then God was propping them up, and God has always sent people from his, when they were called and needed, to prop up these nations and certainly to come to the rescue of the Jews. Jeremiah and Ezekiel both had promised the Jews, even when they went into captivity, before they went into captivity, that they would be resurrected, they would be restored at some point. That even though they would go through this period of captivity, Jeremiah and Ezekiel, as I said, perhaps as much as 100 years earlier, not quite 100 years earlier, but many years earlier, that even though they would be enslaved by first the Assyrians for the northern people, and the southern ones would be enslaved by the Babylonians, he promised them that at least Judah would be resurrected and restored. And so we find that was fulfilled, wasn't it? Well, during this period then, Babylon lasted about 70 years. That was about all it lasted. It had one really, really great king, Nebuchadnezzar, and then it had some others that were okay, but they were in decline pretty rapidly. Remember, too, that the Jews that were exiled to Babylon had a pretty good life. The Babylonians were pretty... they were very, very magnanimous toward the Jews. They didn't restrict their worship services. They let them worship God. They put them in their own little community and left them alone. They used the brightest and the best of the Jews. Remember, of course, Daniel. Remember, Daniel was taken into captivity in the first Babylonian invasion in 605 B.C. That was the first one that the Babylonians took. And then you find then the second time in 597, then people like Ezekiel was taken, and many others were taken to Babylon and settled in a community. And then they weren't through because the Jews had a hard time understanding, and they're a little slow sometimes. Maybe they just kept thinking, well, we can just make alliances with Egypt, or we can make alliances with somebody else, and they'll protect us against these Babylonians. It took three tries to finally figure out that wasn't going to happen. And in 586 or 587 BC, remember the final invasion of Babylon, where they took the remaining folks and took them into captivity in Babylon. And while they were there, Jewish civilization, Jewish worship services changed totally, didn't they? Where did they sacrifice once they were in Babylon in captivity? You ever think about that? They didn't, did they? In fact, they've not offered a sacrifice again until they restored the temple upon return under Ezra's guidance about 525 B.C. So during captivity, they didn't offer a burnt offering. And if they had, they would have been violating God's ordinance, right? Because God had told them the only place you sacrifice is on Mount Zion. Well, during that captivity, of course, lots of things happened to the Jews, and I won't go into all the details, but they formed political parties. During the captivity in Babylon is when the Sadducees and Pharisees were created. These were political parties, believe it or not. If you look at what they did, they were very much like our political parties today. They had great fundamental differences of opinion about a lot of things. Now, I won't go into all the details. The Sadducees only believed in the first five books of the Old Testament. The Pharisees believed in those, plus the prophets. It was quite a different thing. The Pharisees were looking for a Messiah. The Sadducees didn't believe in the Messiah. The Sadducees believed that what you get here and now is all you're going to get. So, anyway, all that, and other parties like Herodians were formed later, and so all that happened while they were in captivity or a little later. Something else happened. They learned to worship differently, didn't they? When they were in captivity in Babylon, they didn't have the sacrifices offered. So instead, they formed synagogues. This is the first case that they would worship in a synagogue. So a group of it had to have a group of 10 men, adults, that would meet together. And if they had 10 or more, then they could have a synagogue. And so they started the synagogue worship. they continued to read the scriptures, they continued to revere the scriptures, and they preserved those. But of course, Babylonian captivity ended in 538 BC officially, when Cyrus, the king of Persia, defeated the Babylonians, and he issued a decree. This was called a decree of Cyrus, simple enough. And he released the Jews to go back to their homeland. And then subsequent to that, within a few years, he also, not he, but other Persian kings, also financed not only rebuilding of the temple, but also later, about 100 years later, the building of the wall under Nehemiah. Jerusalem was devastated. So not only did they need to rebuild a temple, but they also needed to build a wall, because all these guys have always wanted to invade each other. And if you don't have a wall, you're in trouble, right? Everybody's got to have a wall back in those days. Well, during the height of the Persian Empire then, a descendant of a vowed enemy of Israel showed up in the story of Esther. You know him. His name is Haman in the scripture. He was of what nationality was he? It says he was an Agite. An Agite. Do you know anything about the Agites? Where do you find that term? How about Agag? Do you know Agag? Agag is a term that was mentioned. King Agag was a king of the Amalekites. Go back to Moses now. Okay? And as soon as the Jews came into the Sinai Peninsula, when they were escaping the Exodus, they were being skirmished with, as I might say, as they came down the Arabian Peninsula, coming out of Egypt. Very early, these Amalekites, who were descended from Esau, who were enemies of the Jews, these Amalekites would skirmish the tail end of the Jewish. The weakest ones would trail along behind, probably, and so they would skirmish with them and steal stuff and just make life miserable for them. And they did that as they left Rephidim, which is one of the beginning places of their 40-year wandering. And you can find that, I think it's in 1 Kings chapter 15, I believe. That may be wrong, I don't remember for sure. But anyway, it was when Saul was king, and eventually Saul was told by God to destroy the Amalekites and to kill all of them. And what do you know what he did? This is a real big problem, a real big sin for King Saul. He made a real mistake by not obeying God. He didn't kill all of them, did he? He left one of them alive, the king, right? Agag. And as a result of leaving King Agag alive, God repented of appointing Saul as, or letting Samuel appoint Saul. God wasn't for appointing a king in the first place, was he? But he let the Hebrews have their way. But he certainly repented and said, I regret naming Saul as king. And Samuel finally ended up making sure that Agag was killed. But Agag was a term that was used for the king of the Amalekites. There were many Agags over the years. So when it says Agagite, that means he was a descendant, I think. Now, there's some discussion about that. Not everybody agrees on it. But I think this man, Haman, was descended from the Amalekites. So he was an avowed enemy from historically way back of the Jews. And so the book of Esther really is all about this descendant of this avowed enemy plotting a way to practice genocide on the Jews. That's amazing, isn't it? Genocide against the Jews. Have we heard that before? At the turn of the 19th century, remember, the Germans, of course, the Austrians started a war. And World War I, was fought between the Axis and the Allied powers, and it was a brutal war. Well, Germany and Austria lost that war, and it was very devastating to their military mentality, I guess you'd say. And as a result, when you lose something, you lose a battle, you always got to figure out somebody to blame, right? So who did the Jews, or who did, I've answered the question, who did the Austrians and Germans blame? Well, the Jews. Jews, over history, Jews gotten blamed for a lot of stuff, and some of them deserve it, but Hitler tried to, you know, his final solution was eradication of the Jews. So we have in recent history seen the same kind of plot. The Germans also plotted to completely practice genocide against the Jews. Unfortunately, God has had different plans, even though in World War II, of course, during the war, as many as 6 to 9 million Jews were eradicated. And I've had the sobering experience of standing in front of Dachau, just north of Munich, and looking into that place with a sign up above that says, work will make you free, in German. And it's a sobering place, and I'll make this comment and then we'll get on with the story. I had always deluded myself into thinking, yeah, but you know, those concentration camps were outside the city. You drive from Munich to Dachau, if you've been there, it's not outside the city. Now, admittedly, they may have grown, but hey, it's close enough. There's no way you could deny that it was there. So it's a very sobering thing to see. Well, the same thing was happening here. First of all, you know the story of Esther. We don't know how Esther and her custodian, her adopted father, if you will, Mordecai. By the way, there's a good name. If you ever want to name one of your grandchildren something, we'll just suggest Mordecai. It's better than Mephibosheth. So. Those are all good biblical names, but nobody uses them anymore. David, John, all that stuff, you know, we got lots of those, but we don't have very many Mordecais, and we certainly don't have very many Mephibosheths. The department I normally teach in has people my age, so we don't have to worry too much about naming that, but we did have a young couple come in, and they had twins, and I suggested that, and I've never gotten anybody too interested in it for some reason. But anyway, we don't know how Mordecai and Esther. By the way, Esther is the Persian translation of that name. Her name in Hebrew is a little hard to pronounce for me, so I'll just use Esther. But Mordecai was her cousin, and he was looking after her. She was his uncle's daughter, and she had lost all of her family, and so Mordecai was looking out for her. And we don't know how she got from Babylon. Once the decree of Cyrus was given, the Jews could go back out of Babylon and go back home. And many of them did, like Ezra, for example, and later Nehemiah, they led a bunch of people from Babylon to their homeland in Israel. But others of them stayed. Some of them stayed in Babylon. And we don't know how Mordecai and Esther got 200 miles east of Babylon, but they were in Susa, which is the capital of Persia, an ancient capital of Persia. So they were there. We don't know exactly what led them there. We don't even know how the Agagite got there, but we know they were there. And so Esther, God used, as I said, God had different plans, and he had promised the Israelites, the Judahites, he promised them in Jeremiah and Ezekiel that he would restore their kingdom. And God used a very humble, very insignificant, beautiful girl and her cousin to thwart the plans of a diabolical enemy of the Jews, and to restore the nation. Now, if you think of the implications here, by the way, there's from this lineage, you know, you can trace the Messiah. And And if you think about it, if the Agagite had been successful, what would history have been like? The Jews would have been eradicated. The Messiah would not have come through the lineage that had been prophesied. Now, that wasn't going to happen because God had already willed it to happen. But, you know, you think of the impact of some innocent young girl who was had nothing going for her other than she was beautiful. And God used her and her cousin to avoid complete eradication of the Jews. We don't have much time to talk about the scripture, but I want to just say that you're familiar with the story, I'm sure. If you're not, you ought to read it. It's a great story. And remember that Haman, there were two things about the... I guess there's really two things about the king of Persia that you ought to know in reading this. One is he was God. To the Persians, he was God. Like so many of these rulers, they thought that he was divinely authorized. And if he made a law, and this has been historically verified, not only in the Bible, but if he made a law, it was a law that could not be repealed. Okay? So once he made a commitment and made a however you want to say, a papal bull, or in Muslim word terms, you know, the tradition of a imam who makes a pronouncement, that became law. And well, it was true of the Persian king. Once he made an edict or a law and put his signet ring and seal of the king down, then it couldn't be repealed under any circumstance. So this was a difficult thing. The other thing that you need to know in reading this book is no one could go to before the Persian king without him asking for them to come. So we've got this little woman. You know the story. Obviously, it's a great story in the sense that it was one of the early... Men have always been concerned about women rebelling, you know, and not doing the stuff we want them to do. Remember, these guys were really worried because the king had a wife named Vashti, and she was probably the first women's liberator, if you will. And he tried to get her. He was in a drunken stupor at a party. He decided he wanted to display his wife with her crown. I don't know whether she had anything other than her crown. We don't know that. Doesn't tell us that detail, but you kind of wonder, and you kind of think that might be the case. She was more dignified than that in any case, and so she wouldn't cooperate. She wouldn't come out. And as a result, then all these soothsayers and these wise men and philosophers and astronomers and astrologists and all these guys that advised the king of Persia said, man, we can't let this stand. If we do, then all these women are going to rebel, and none of them are going to do what we want them to do. And that made them, that really got them worried. So they told him, they told the king, you better get rid of that woman. That Vashti woman's causing you trouble. So he did. He dumped his wife. And then he started looking for another one. And so the way they chose, they chose the new queen, of course, which was Esther, eventually, is they brought them each one before him, and they chose a group of the prettiest ones, and they sent them through a year's cosmetic school to learn how to really, really clean up and look really good. And after a year, then, each one of them would be called by the king, and if they found favor with the king, then he would select from that group. And Esther was found to be the fairest of them all. Well, all this time then, Haman was also scheming against the Jews. Haman was going to the Persian king and saying, hey, you know, there's a man that won't... And he was jealous because Mordecai wouldn't bow down to him, remember? And he was supposed to bow down. I know we're running late, so I'll hurry. And so he decided, I'm going to get back at that Jew. I'm going to go in and talk to the king of Persia into letting me eradicate all you guys, including Mordecai. So he went in and said, hey, I'll pay you a huge amount of money. I've forgotten how many thousand talents of silver it was, but he was depending on, like the Germans did in World War II, he was depending on getting the wealth from the Jews in order to pay the ransom that he promised the king. And the king needed money because he was starting to fight with the Greeks, and he needed money to finance his wars. So he said, "Oh, great! Here, I won't even draw the law up or the edict that you could do this. I'll just give you the signet ring." That's like giving somebody the key to your safe deposit box, isn't it? Well, that's what he did. And as a result of that, then Haman had full reign. He passed a law that said on a certain day, actually cast lots for a date, and he decided a date that they were going to kill all the Jews. And so he gave out that pronouncement that all the Jews were going to be killed. And so Mordecai, by that time, was also influential in the courtyard of the king, but not so much that he could get that turned around. But he appealed. By that time, Esther was chosen as a replacement for Vashti. So he appealed to Esther and said, you must go into the king and tell him what's going on and reveal to him Haman's scheme. And one of the most famous things in this book, and if you don't read anything but this, you ought to read chapter 4, verses 13 and 14. Listen to what Mordecai told Esther. Then Mordecai told them to reply. These are people that came back and said, Esther says she can't go in because the king hadn't asked her to come before him. And you can't go before the king without him being asked. Mordecai told them to respond to Esther, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this." That's pretty eloquent, isn't it? He's saying, if you don't do it, God's going to have somebody else. And if you think you can get by with it, or you think we can escape as Jews, you're wrong. So through that, of course, through that action, she did appeal to the king, and the king actually hung. It ends up that Haman had already built a gallows for Mordecai. And remember, that gallows was used for Haman instead. And God kept his promise as written in Jeremiah and Ezekiel. Okay, well, I've taken more time than I'm supposed to. I apologize for trying to pack so much into such a short period of time, but I think perspective is important when you're reading something like this to know what's going on and why. And certainly we can learn lessons. Not only will you find things like this, these kind of plots against the Jews in the Bible, but we know we've seen plots against them in our days as well. So anyway, thank you for having me. I guess I can do the red heifer some other time. Thank you.